The Boy Who Could Fly from 1986. This has, for me, and I know many, many others that are, you know, super fans of this music as well as the movie, it really sticks with us all these decades later, and it's in a really, really great tune. This one, not in E-flat, this one's in C. Right, yeah. But it's a really interesting movie. I mean, it was... You look back on it now in the 1980s, and it fits into the 1980s. It's like, okay, obviously, this is from 1986. But at the time, you know, this idea that this autistic boy who, you know, fell in love with this girl across the way, across the window, so to speak, and he had this special power, that's an interesting kind of posit from a composer perspective and certainly from a screenwriter's perspective. This scene here, which I'd love to share with our listeners, this is the scene where he finally flies with Millie. So looking at this, the kind of the culmination of this entire film where his magical power is finally now revealed and it ends up with him finally speaking for the first time, you know, saying goodbye and saying, I love you. What a beautiful scene. I mean, it's really a very poignant film in general, but particularly this scene. And kind of, you know, away from Silverado, you hear you got the strings playing that beautiful melody up top in the first position. It's great.
I'll tell you a funny story about this that actually it's not specifically about the movie, but several years later, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, I had written a piece for band, which I then transcribed into orchestra called American Hero. And it was written to celebrate, it had been commissioned by the Air Force to celebrate the life of the man, I forget his name, General Robert somebody, who wrote a book called God is My Co-Pilot. It was a famous book, had been made into a movie. And so I'm thinking, gee, maybe the Hollywood Bowl could play this for the 4th of July. So I called up John Malcherry and I told him about the piece. And he said, does it have anything to do with flying? And he said, because this is the 100th anniversary of flight. And I said, well, yeah, it actually does. So I said, well, send it to me. I want to hear it. So I sent it to them and they eventually played it. So anyway, I put a CD and I put my score into the envelope and I address it to John Malcherry and I call up the messenger. An hour later, the messenger shows up at the door and it's this guy, it's Jay, the kid who played the boy who could fly. He's the messenger.
Oh, you know? Eric,
and
interesting. And
commercials and things like that. And I said, and we had never met before, but as soon as he saw me, he laughed, you know, we both laughed. And I said, what's going on with you? What is this? I said, acting didn't work out well or whatever. He says, no. He says, acting work has been working out fine. He says, but I'm leaving acting and I'm going into the seminary. I'm going to be a minister. And I thought, man, this is really weird. God is my co-pilot. I'm delivering the music to the boy who could fly. This is just really too weird, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my boy who could fly story. This was a funny movie because it made the studio nervous. They actually tried it out with the title blocked out. They were afraid that the title, The Boy Who Could Fly, gave away the story. Well, sort of.
Spoiler alert.
And they weren't sure about the score. They thought it sounded too much like something else, and it was kind of murky. But I will say the thing that I remember about the movie, and I remember it really well, is I liked the movie, but I really liked the director. Mm-hmm. And he and another composer, who's a friend of mine, are very good friends. And he tried to get the other composer. And when the studio didn't want that, and they chose me because I guess I was hot at the moment, it was never an issue. I mean, it was like I was the first guy that he had ever met who had ever composed. You know, I mean, he was just the greatest guy, still is. I don't see him. I haven't seen him for years, but it was a really nice experience. And so I have warm feelings for the movie. I can't tell. I'm interested to hear what you're saying about it because I see it from a different perspective, but it's a nice movie. And it's one of those movies, for some reason, I ended up doing a lot of family movies. This is probably the first one. And like Homeward Bound and Rescuers and things like that, things mm-hmm. that people remember seeing when they were kids. And this is one of them. This is the first one. You can see the people in it, how young they were, because this movie was done a long time ago. But I always had a good warm feeling for this movie and the tune. I like the tune. It's a long, tune. Long, long, long tune.
Yeah, it is. You're right about that. You mentioned Homeward Bound and Rescuers. Those are just two of the more recent movies, due to all of us kind of being under quarantine, I've shared with my two little girls.
I've come across that with your little girls who are now adults. I mean, with other people.
Yeah.
And it's been amazing to me the influence of some of this music. And I have to credit that it's music in a film. So it's really the film, it's the music that's accompanying the film. But I've had the most incredible things said to me about scores like Homeward Bound, saying, this music changed my life. Or the first time I was ever aware of it, a girl came up in a hair salon. I was there to pick up my wife. And she's a young girl. She was about 23, 24. She was taking appointments and all that stuff. And I'd been there a couple of times. And she walked up to me. And she said, I just figured out who you are. And I said, oh, really? Who's that? And she said, you're Bruce Broughton. You're the man who wrote the music to The Rescuers Down Under. Yeah. And I said, why do you know this? She said, because that was my favorite movie as a little girl. And I've watched it over and over and over again. Would you sign my CD? I thought, wow, what a weird story. But I've had that story in one shape or another follow me for 20 years. And, it's really great. I mean, it's really great because your story is even better because people are still watching it. Kids are still watching it. So you feel like you did something good with your life, you know?
Yeah, I think certainly as parents, and one of our jobs is to live vicariously through the context of our children's eyes and, kind of sharing with them the things that we loved as children, just to kind of see how they might react and, share that experience, 30 years later, so to speak. It's a lot of fun. So let's kind of pivot away from film just for a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about themed entertainment. We touched on it a little bit with Spaceship Earth, but one of the sessions I went to of yours when I was young and in the first kind of throes of us getting to know one another years ago, when you recorded all this new music for Spaceship Earth, I look back, and now I think the ride is being renovated as of a few months ago at Epcot,
I think it may have stopped, yeah.
I mean, well, right, along along with everything, but the music, when you the recording you did back in the early 2000s, forget what year exactly. One of the challenges that you had shared on that particular project was the looping effect. How are you going to solve the looping effect of having that music, you know, kind of like the small world effect, so to speak, I guess, to kind of sum it up for people. That's that same music over and over, but fresh and unique with the new room. Walk us through some of just Spaceship Earth. And I got a couple others I'd like to bring up too, but this one I love.
Well, Spaceship Earth, I had been on the ride, the previous ride, years before. And the thing that I remember, and I was kind of snotty about it when I talked to the guys, was that it seemed to break down. You know, you're riding on these little carts and then every once in a while they'd stop. And you go, oh, gee, you know, if the ride stops, you figure there's got to be some problems. So we were having a meeting, I guess it was the final production meeting, and I mentioned that. And they said, no, there are reasons why that happens, because primarily for safety, you want to make sure that if you have a disabled person who comes on, you don't want to throw them on the ride. You know, you stop the ride, you make sure that they're safe. Mm-hmm. And then as you go up that first ramp, there's a safety announcement. So the whole thing with Disney, I mean, I think the Disney theme parks, frankly, are an incredible it's not just the level of entertainment, it's the level of production and concern, actually human concern. If you have to stand in a long line, even that they try to make fun, you know, in some ways. So they give you little pre-show things to look at and all that stuff. So they said, apropos of that, we have one problem that you're going to have to solve, and we don't know how you're going to solve it. They said, the beginning of the ride has these little rooms that are eras or epics in history. Like we have the room for the Romans, the room for the Egyptians, the room for the Phoenicians, and they're right next to each other. And so as the tram is going by, you hear the Phoenician music and then you hear the Egyptian music. And if you should stop and you're stuck between two rooms, you're going to hear both music.
Yeah.
And we don't know what you're going to do about that. Well, it was easy. I thought, well, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to do Small World. Because Small World is the same thing. You know, you take this long ride and everybody's singing the same song, but they're singing in different lyrics.
Right.
They're singing different languages, you know, and it doesn't bother you at all. Over here, they've got a banjo because they're doing it in Texas. Over here, they have something else because they're doing it in Japan. And over here, they're in Romania. And over here, you know, it's like that. And it all goes together just fine. So I wrote a piece that could be, I think there are four rooms together. This is like being in college again, you know. So I wrote a chaconne, which is an old Baroque style of variation, which is a harmonic variation. So I wrote a chaconne, I wrote out my chords, and then I put all of the pieces in the same tempo and over the same chords. And I constructed them so that one could be played against the other. And then on my sequencer, I put all four versions together and played them all at once to make sure that if anything stuck out, I'd pull it out and I'd change it. Simple. But along with that, the thing that I really liked about Disney, and I'd done several of the theme park shows before Space Mountain or Spaceship Earth. The thing I liked about the Disney thing is that only with Disney could you get a problem like that. Because every time you took on, I mean, seriously, every time you took on a new show, I used to say to the guys, I said, you know, every time I see one of these shows, I don't know what the heck I'm going to do because I don't have a clue as to what's happening here.
Yeah.
And you're bringing me problems that I don't know how to solve, but in a couple of weeks, I'll have it all figured out, you know? And the guys are like the best guys in the world to work with. I love doing the theme park stuff. I love doing animation because everything has been figured out. The people are super smart.
Yeah.
They're super committed to what their work is. You know, they're super creative. It's just the greatest bunch of guys. And the the anxiety that they have is a creative anxiety. It's not, will this work? Will this work? We know that it's going to work, and it's going to be there for several years, and millions of people are going to see it. They just want to make sure everybody gets the biggest bang for their buck. They're great jobs and great people who work on them.
One of the other things that sticks out for me, and this is not only because of how well the music is constructed and the history of the ride, so to speak, but I wanted to bring this up because due to Jerry Goldsmith, you know, who was a friend of both of us. And when you redid the music to Soarin' Over California, and it was a Soarin' Over the World, or, you know, is that what it's called? Soarin' Over the World now?
Yeah.
And this is almost like kind of a curiosity question, and only because I know you are a very well-studied composer who is very, very careful with every decision you make. There's a moment in that where we go to Egypt, and I could be totally wrong. It could be coincidental, in which case, tell me if it is. But there's a moment in there where it seemed like there was kind of almost an intentional tambourine, low tom-tom reference, boom, to The Mummy by Goldsmith when you're in Egypt.
I've never heard that before. No, that's
really?
That's okay. Entirely, you know, but it was probably my homage to Jerry. Not that we needed one, but
right. You know, it's that one, you know, it's, you look at kind of the history of that ride, and I remember turning to my wife the first time that we went on that ride after it had been redone, you know, prior to Jerry's version, and it was your version. I looked at her, and this is not an exaggeration. I turned her to the left and I said, you know, I think Bruce probably wrote this music because you can tell it's incredibly well written. That's a great one. You know, maybe you can kind of walk us through a little bit of how you were approached about being a part of the redo.
Actually, you know, I really got into the theme parks, not the making of me, not the very first one, but with the people who I continued to work with all the way through that. I initially got into because of Jerry. Mm-hmm. The first one I did was Time After Time. There's a French word they use for it. Time After, which is one of these circle vision things. And Jerry was supposed to do the ride. Mm-hmm. And he was still working on a movie, so he couldn't do the ride. So I got the job. I've had two or three jobs, like Baby's Day Out and Tombstone, where Jerry was supposed to do it and he fell out. So I got to do it. So I, you know, aside from the fact that I just absolutely adored his music and thought he was a great guy and all that kind of stuff, it was such a great job to get Soarin' Over the World because I got to use Jerry's material, which people were always oohing and aahing about anyway. And I got to work with his stuff.
Yeah.
So I got his scores, and there's a lot of stuff in the movie. I mean, there's a lot of it that's been rewritten, of course, and been reorganized. But there are some things that are pretty much the way that Jerry wrote them for the first one. I mean, whenever it fit, I could use his fanfare and his theme and all that kind of stuff. That's all Jerry. And then I filled in all the other kind of stuff. It was... again, I mean, it was one of those theme park things that when would you get a chance to do this again? I mean, as a movie, that Soarin' ride is the best ride in the park, period.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether you're 90 years old or you're 10 years old. It is absolutely the best ride in the park. But when would I get a chance to work with essentially my hero, my musical hero,
yeah,
who isn't available and is entrusting me in a sort of way to be able to do his stuff well, you know? And so, yeah, it's me and it's Jerry. It's me and it's Jerry. In fact, one of his themes doesn't finish. So on the pre-show, I've done a couple of different pre-shows. I just did one a year or so ago for Tokyo Sea.
Yeah.
Where I had to continue his tune. So his tune is like half Jerry and half Bruce. I don't know how he'd feel about it, but I felt good about it. So anyway, yeah. that was a real honor to be able to work on that one.
But you did add some new things to it for sure. I mean, you brought your voice to it, which I immediately identified, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that identified it. And you brought your quality level of composition, which, you know, look, I'll say it loud and clear. And I know all of our listeners agree with this. You are a composer's composer, as I said before, and we all look up to you, and you bring consistently this level of quality. It just reminds me of a story. I remember years ago we were talking about, there was this, I forget what movie this was, you were working on it maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and you wrote this this 8-part fugue to a dialogue scene, and you were kind of joking about it with me after the fact. It's like, well, this is your words. I'm not so sure I should have written the 8-part fugue, but it sure was a lot of fun. And I share that story only because there's not all that many people, honestly, that would not only attempt to write an 8-part fugue right now in film and television, but might not even really know how to do it in a really, really great way. And, you know, so I mean that in a very complimentary way. But that was a fun story.
I don't remember what that is. Probably a lot of other guys would do it with a whole note, and that would work pretty well, too.
It could. That G, that's a great whole note. We'll pivot to one of the other fun ones that we love over at California Adventure, and it's not so much a ride as it is about the mood that it creates, and that, of course, is the music you wrote for the kind of the Napa Valley experience that's there.
Oh, yeah.
And I really do love that one because it's a departure from all the other things that not only you hear in the park, but some of the things, and I'm not aware of every note you've written in the theme parks, full disclosure, spoiler alert, but I'm aware of a lot of it, and for me, as someone who looks up to you and listens to a lot of your stuff, even to this day, really, that one's a departure, I think, and it feels new and different and from all the other things you've written. Was that one where you just kind of you were given to say, hey, look, this is Napa, figure it out, or did they have very specific directions for you on that?
No, it was a movie. It was a movie about Mondavi.
Oh, that's right. Inside the Little Air. Yeah.
Yeah. And who we got a chance to meet, which was kind of cool. The other thing that makes that one a little bit different is that one had a real budget. Mm-hmm. It was like you say, it wasn't a ride. It was actually a film. You walked in and you looked at the making of wines and particularly from, and you met Mondavi on the screen, all that kind of stuff. And it had a unusually small music budget for that thing. So what I ended up doing, I think I had a string quartet and a few live players. I remember I had one or two guitars, and then I had a synth background, which was making the strings a little larger, but all the real tricky stuff was done with the quartet. And when the quartet played with the strings, then it all sort of sounded together and all that kind of stuff. So it was a half and half kind of a score. And it just turned out really well. I mean, yeah. I love these theme park things, you know, but it just turned out really well. And I think that because I focus so much on just two or three or six or seven players, because it was really an intimate kind of a thing, in an intimate kind of a movie, in an intimate space, it took on that kind of a quality that the other ones, which, you know, when you've got 9 screens around you, you don't do intimate, you just do big and you blow it out the walls.
Mm-hmm. It's, looking back at all the things you've done, even just for our local parks, you know, Disneyland and California Adventure, not the least of which, I should say this, as a local guy who goes to Disneyland, I've been going to Disneyland since I was, 2 feet tall because I grew up in Huntington Beach. There's something special about Disneyland, right? You know, and California Adventure, when it extended out, given that kind of everything started out here, as far as themed entertainment for Walt. And there's a magic that I think a lot of people feel out here. And I'm not saying there isn't any magic at Epcot or in Tokyo. There certainly is. But a lot of the things that go through, I don't know if this is the right phrase to use, but the testing phases. I can't imagine what all the Imagineers, so to speak, are having to go through, what phases and at what phase someone like you may come in. But that might be something worth kind of highlighting for our listeners is, you know, at what point do you generally see your involvement in the themed entertainment scape? Because it is an interesting one. It's different than film. And, you know, it's not where, you know, the movie's in the can. You've watched it, you spotted the film, and you go record. It's much more of a, I imagine, a collaborative endeavor.
Yeah, it is. It's. I don't think I've ever read a script on one of these things. I've worked often over the years with one of the producers, Tom Fitzgerald. And Tom is, I mean, he's a wonderful guy. We're really good friends. I mean, you know, our partners and everybody, I mean, we're good friends, and I've been with him a long time. He's been with Disney a long time. I think where we're similar is that as a kid, he, as soon as he could get a job, I think he started working with Disneyland, doing one of the theme rides or something like that. And then he got into Imagineering. Well, for him, it's a dream job. For me, when I was a boy, although I studied music when I was a kid, I really wanted to be an animator. And Walt Disney was my hero. So when Disneyland opened, it opened on a Sunday. I was there on Wednesday. I was 10 years old. My brother and I think I was 10 years old. My brother was 8.
Wow.
Our parents dropped us off at the gate. We spent the whole day running around the park. You'd never do that. You'd never do that now. And it was like the time of our lives. So we went to Disneyland often and often and often. And so when I got a chance to do these theme parks, that was really exciting. And when I got a chance to do, I know we're talking about theme parks, but I'll just put in this thing. When I was asked to do Rescuers Down Under, which was a fully animated film, I was no longer an animator. And thank God I didn't become one, because those guys are really good. But the chance to work on a Walt Disney animated film, much less a Walt Disney anything, was incredible. So, look, I mean, if I don't spend a lot of time looking backward, but when I do, you know, I get some really warm feelings out of, well, you know, we were talking about Homeward Bound and Rescuers Down Under. Those are Disney movies. You know, those Disney movies were the, I don't know, it just felt like my life came around to be extraordinarily appreciative. In the theme parks, you get the music at the end. They've already figured out all this stuff. And they're still working on their stuff, but they know the size of the room. They know how the ride works. Richard Bellis has a very funny story about having to time the, what's the name of it?
Raiders March. Raiders March.
Yeah, Raiders. Okay, yeah, the Raiders. He had to time all that because it was his job to put together all that music. Yeah. And it's hysterical, you know, they're bouncing up and down thing. But they know technically how it works. They know how long it takes to have the doors open to get all the people into the attraction, and they know how long it takes to get them out. One of the things you often have to write with these things is something called a fill and a spill. And I asked them, what does this mean? What's a fill? The fill is the music you write as the people come into the auditorium. The spill is what you write when you go out. This stuff is all timed. I mean, they know exactly how long it takes everybody to go in. So they give you all these timings, and you know when the doors close, you know when the lights go on, you know when that's going to happen, you know when your cue starts. All of this stuff has been worked out. There's no screwing around with it. And then when it's done, you look at the show. Like I remember on Ellen's Energy Adventure, it was in a huge panorama where they had people movers that actually moved through this thing. We did that. We walked through the show. We saw the entire attraction. We did the whole experience. You have to, because they're going to have millions of people. I mean, literally millions of people are going to come through and look at this over the next several years. So they're very exciting things to do. And you know, you take, at least I do, I take the job really seriously, because I realize you're going to get letters. You're going to get emails from people, or they're going to ask you a question about, you know, when you turn the corner there, I hear a trumpet. Did you mean to play a B flat, or was that supposed to be a, you know, you get
That's
crazy
great.
Questions. I mean, you actually do get questions like that. And then you also get people who I mean, it's very moving. I've gotten emails, even just recently, people who just write to thank me for the enjoyment that they've gotten over my music over the years. Sometimes they particularly like this show or that theme park thing or whatever it is. It's really amazing. I mean, I'm just a composer, you know, I'm just sitting here pushing notes around trying to get something out from the inside. But the feedback on it is, God, it's great. I mean, it's really, you know, it's really heartwarming.
Brought to you by Cine Concerts.